This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Way Forward for the Palestinian People. In the neonatal intensive care unit of Gaza City's main hospital, on Monday, January 21st, physician Radwan Hassouna tapped the plastic incubator of Karam Alnami, one of the 1.5-pound twins, and ticked off the electrical equipment keeping the baby alive. He has a ventilator. He has an oxygenator. He has phototherapy, or light to keep him from developing jaundice, Hassouna said. An intravenous pump, he added, and monitors. If the generators break down, Karam and his twin brother Karim would die in an instant, Hassouna said. Karam and his twin brother Karim are among the 30 premature babies at the hospital who would die if power remained off. Meanwhile, in Gaza's second-largest medical facility, the European Hospital in the southern Gaza Strip, the surgeons were forced to suspend all major surgical operations. We have in Gaza, since Friday, the Israelis suspended all fuel deliveries. They blockaded the entrance to Gaza. And then, after much European dissent, after a call from Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, after Egyptians, Jordanians, and Palestinians were demonstrating in Jordan, before the parliament, in the West Bank, and in Egypt, then Defense Minister Ehud Barak agreed on Monday, the 21st, to allow a one-time shipment of diesel fuel and medical supplies into the Gaza Strip. This still maintaining the Israeli-imposed closure that's leaving this coastal area of 1.5 million Palestinians without essential supplies. Collective punishment, it's been called, but more so, it is the strangulation of the Palestinian people. Today on Taking Aim, we will talk about the way forward. Ralph?
Amira Haas in Haaretz on today's in today's newspaper describes the following: Palestinian Water Authority, 40% of Gazans lack running water. Gaza residents move from worrying about the elimination of electricity to an elimination of water. The municipality needs electricity to bring water to the homes. The houses needed to pump water to the roof tanks. 40% of Gaza's homes, 600,000 people, have no running water. Oxfam International stated, sewage system collapse is imminent in their statement today. Without electric power, we can manage somehow without bread too, said a resident of the Nasser neighborhood in northern Gaza. It's cold enough to prevent the food from going back. We open the refrigerator as little as possible. We calculate every step. We don't put on gas heaters because tomorrow will be colder. We don't cook for more than a minute. We consider whether to go to the toilet, whether to wash our face. Our lives are insufferable. The Israeli human rights organization Adalah and Gisha petitioned the High Court of Justice, citing the fact that these shortages derive from Israel's deliberate cutting of all supplies, power cuts causing a shortage of drinking water, devastation to the hospital functioning when Gaza's electric power production was cut by 30%. The High Court of Justice dismissed their request.
Ralph, according to the United Nations, even before this blockade on Gaza, 80% of Gazans live in poverty. And as far as water, according to the United Nations, the water available to people in the West Bank and in Gaza is only one half of international standards. The international standard is 150 liters per person per day, but because the Zionists have siphoned off the water that should go to the West Bank, the water from the Jordan River, have prevented the Palestinians from digging wells, and have essentially blockaded water in the Gaza Strip, the amount of water that is available for Palestinians is 75 liters per day per person in Gaza and 80.5 liters per day in the West Bank. And according to the United Nations, two-thirds of the Palestinian population is not hooked up to a sewerage system. These are the basics of sanitation and the necessity for life that exists throughout the world. And yet this is what the Zionists have been doing, strangling the Palestinian population, in a way forcing the Palestinians to make the decision to either live in the most extreme situation of poverty or to leave. The purpose of the Zionist project? Expel the Palestinian population, seize the entire land of Palestine, eliminate the indigenous population. And this is what we have been discussing for the past six Taking AIM programs. It has been a long series. And today on Taking AIM, we want to address the way forward, something that Ralph and I have been talking about for over a quarter of a century. Ralph?
Well, Maya, just to before we begin the description of the what we call a revolutionary strategy in Palestine, which is part of the discussion in the Hidden History of Zionism, the United Nations report is so overwhelming in its demonstration of what has happened in the West Bank and Gaza, and the deliberation of the deliberate policy of the siege. And it actually is a page out of the playbook of the Nazis with the siege of the Warsaw Ghetto. The poverty rate is at 57%, 0.1%, according to the UN report. Food insecurity affects 35% of the population. The impact particularly severe in Gaza, which is sealed off from the rest of the world. Few residents can now exit Gaza. Medical emergency defines the entire territory. There are no commercial or humanitarian supplies that are allowed to enter. There is a complete halt to the import of raw materials and exports. The wider world has resulted in 75,000 Gazans being laid off. Dependency on agencies such as UNRWA and the WFP in Gaza stands at 80%. In the West Bank, the closure regime has impeded access to workplace markets and to health and education services. The number of physical obstacles, including checkpoints, has increased from 528 to 563. The barrier has been expanded. It already has accounted for 9.5% of the West Bank, totally isolated. The report is absolutely overwhelming. The tightening of these restrictions, the expansion of the barrier, the expanding presence, and I'm reading from the Israeli infrastructure in the West Bank, the settlements, the outposts, the military infrastructure, adds to the geographic, political, and economic fragmentation to the total detriment of livelihood and future liability. It's a very long report. Every sentence of it is a steaming description of a people scheduled for total destruction.
Ralph, 40% of the West Bank itself, that is 22% of historic Palestine, 40% of the West Bank is covered, as you mentioned, by settlements, outposts, military infrastructure, nature reserves, and closed areas west of the barrier wall, the separation wall that is in the process of still winding its way throughout the West Bank, separating the West Bank from pre-67 Israel. 40%. This means that Palestinians are relegated to 11% of the historic Palestine, those who remain in the West Bank, 11%. Now, the idea of 11% separated. These are not contiguous areas. And this is what was supposedly a Palestinian entity for the West Bank, the precursor of what was to be a Palestinian state, so-called state, a state without control of its foreign affairs, a state relegated to it being a police force. This is the result of the so-called negotiations over the last number of years. And it is obvious to everyone. As Henry Sigman, a former head of the American Jewish Congress, wrote in the London Review of Books, August 16, 2007, quote, "The Middle East peace process may well be the most spectacular deception in modern diplomatic history. Since the failed Camp David summit of 2000, and actually well before it, Israel's interest in a peace process has been a fiction that has served primarily to provide cover for its systematic confiscation of Palestinian land and an occupation whose goal, according to the former IDF, that's the Israeli Defense Force, Chief of Staff Moshe Yaalon, is to, quote, sear deep into the consciousness of Palestinians that they are a defeated people." Ralph.
Well, Maya, again, 49% of Palestinian households in the West Bank and 79% of Gaza live in poverty. You know what poverty is? It's $1.6 per day, brothers and sisters. You can thereby understand that if 49% and 79% respectively are living on less than $1.6 per day, the real figure about the starvation of, and the immiseration of the people of Palestine in West Bank and Gaza is many multiples of this. The 10,000 Palestinians who live in enclaves that the West Bank has cut off are totally deprived of educational and health services. All of this has resulted in 12 United Nations agencies and 28 non-governmental organizations and 15 international organizations, including the largest in the world, larger than those in operation in Somalia, Zimbabwe, and Chad, to warn of what they call the Somalization of Gaza and to launch an appeal for the survival of the population of the West Bank and Gaza. When such organizations begin to sound this kind of alarm, brothers and sisters, you begin to understand that this is the organized and planned destruction of the Palestinian people, because the object of the exercise from the inception of the Zionist state is to remove the people from the land and from history. That process is relentless, that process is ongoing, that process will never cease as long as the Zionist state is in existence.
And Ralph, the cry, the cri de coeur of these humanitarian agencies is for the survival of a population. But the cry of President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt to the Zionists is that if the Zionists create such a devastating situation for the Palestinian population that it threatens their very survival, that the Egyptians and the Jordanians will not be able to contain their own population, and thus we will have revolutionary upsurge throughout the Arab East, and that the Palestinian revolution that started way back in the 1930s, that this revolution will reemerge, and that it will not be just an anti-colonial struggle against the Ottoman Empire, against the British mandate, that it is going to be a struggle, a true struggle for revolution throughout the Arab East. And that was the cry of President Hosni Mubarak to the Zionist rulers. Let's go to The Hidden History of Zionism and Chapter 13, A Strategy for Revolution. And in preparing for this show, we did quite extensive reading. And after all this and all this discussion between Ralph and myself, we came to the conclusion that what was written 20 years ago by Ralph in A Strategy for Revolution said it best, most concisely, and really presented the issues of which way forward quite poignantly. Ralph, A Strategy for Revolution.
There are over 5 million settlers of European origin in South Africa. The Afrikaner population and those of British descent have lived in South Africa for many generations, over 400 years. Yet very few people, let alone those purporting to be advocates of self-determination for blacks in South Africa, propose two states, a European white state with guaranteed security alongside a demilitarized African state. In fact, it is precisely the existence of such an arrangement in the form of the Bantustans of South Africa which has rendered utterly indefensible this cover for the preservation of racist rule. Similarly, in colonial Algeria and in northern and southern Rhodesia, the large European settler populations, many of them descendants of generations of settlers, were not accorded a separate status, let alone a settler state, on usurped land of the oppressed. On the contrary, in South Africa, as in Algeria, Zambia, or Zimbabwe, it is understood that self-determination of a colonized people cannot be equated with a settler state. It is sleight of hand to suggest that having dispossessed the population by force, the settlers now have an equivalent claim to the conquered territory. If this is universally understood elsewhere, why this indecent exceptionalism when it comes to Israel? Those who would foist upon the Palestinian people the demand that they recognize an apartheid Israeli state know full well that the national rights of a colonized people do not extend to their colonizers. In Israel, no less than in South Africa, minimum justice requires dismantling the apartheid state and replacing it with a democratic, secular Palestine where citizenship and rights are not determined by ethnic criteria.
In reality, the supposed supporters of Palestinian human rights who urge acceptance and recognition of the Israeli state are, however disguised, acting as lawyers for the colonial state in Palestine. Their advocacy carries the pseudo-left cover of self-determination for both peoples. But the specious employment of the principle of self-determination translates into a covert call for amnesty for Israel. Many so-called realists argue that Palestinian acknowledgement of the right of apartheid Israel to exist will hasten the day when a Palestinian state would be permitted by the Zionists to come into being. But this rationalization does not carry much conviction. The Zionists do not depend upon verbal acceptance for their state, but upon armed force. For Palestinians to accept, recognize, and thereby legitimize the murderous conquest of their land would merely permit the Zionists to contend that 40 years of intransigence on the part of the oppressed are responsible for their suffering. And this is now 60 years. It would sanction the claim that Israel was a legitimate construct from the start. Rather than acting as a bridge toward the establishment of a unitary Palestine, as some in the PLO leadership contend today, this was 20 years ago, the establishment of a mini-state on the West Bank and the recognition of the Zionist state, which is a precondition for its creation, would represent a giant obstacle in its path. Recognition of the Israeli state would invalidate, retroactively, the right of resistance of the oppressed and would provide cover for the Zionist demand that only Palestinians who had capitulated and sanctioned Israel in the past, accepting its legitimacy, have the right to negotiate with Israel. When you dance with the devil, your speech reveals his breath. What of the Palestinians who live inside the 1967 borders, and what of the Jews themselves? Would apartheid end in South Africa, or the state be transformed by recognizing its right to exist? Would we serve the interests of the people of Paraguay or Chile by accepting the claims to legitimacy of Stroessner or Pinochet, or by providing sanctions for the states they have constructed?
Despite the obvious answers to all these questions, there are nonetheless an increasing number of people who today are actively pushing for an international peace conference in the Middle East with the goal of establishing a Palestinian mini-state alongside the Israeli state. On January 10, 1988, Al-Fajr, a Jerusalem-Palestinian weekly, published a statement signed by prominent Jews and Arabs which called for, quote, a peaceful resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, unquote, that would, quote, ensure both Israeli and Palestinian national rights, unquote. In an interview with the Reuters press service on January 18, Hanna Signora, editor of Al-Fajr, specified how Israeli and Palestinian, quote, national rights, unquote, might be ensured at such an international peace conference. Signora called for, quote, an association among Israel, Jordan, and a Palestinian state like that of the Benelux countries with a demilitarized West Bank as the Luxembourg, quote, unquote. Quote, Palestinians, including Arafat, would accept autonomy as an interim step, Signora said. Autonomy is a step that would lead eventually to negotiations between the State of Israel and the PLO, ending in a Palestinian state emerging as a result of those negotiations, unquote. Hanna Signora met with Secretary of State George Shultz in Washington on January 28th to discuss this proposal. Signora's meeting occurred only days after PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat had announced that he was interested in making a deal with Israel and the United States. A dispatch from Associated Press on January 17th explained Arafat's overtures. Quote, Arafat says that if those countries, Israel and the United States, agree to an international conference on Middle East peace, he will recognize Israel's right to exist. The White House says this could be an encouraging sign, unquote.
Ralph, I'd like to interject here that in 1998, all this was taking place after there had been the rise of the Intifada, that is, the mass popular resistance that went outside of the PLO. It was the mass mobilization of the Palestinians.
Maya,
1987. Right,
not,
is when
not
the...
Not 1998.
I'm sorry. 1987 is when the first Intifada, the Intifada of the Stone throwing youth. And during this intifada, you had the collective mobilization of the Palestinian masses, where they were setting up their own infrastructure. They were establishing schools, they were setting up popular committees, and all this was done outside the bureaucracy of the PLO. And that is when Chairman Arafat interjected and fulfilled what had been long-standing negotiations and entrees with the U.S. rulers to establish the relationship with the Zionist state, and that's what we discuss here now, a rump Palestinian state. George Ball, who served as Undersecretary of State under the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, spelled out how the United States and Israel should approach an international peace conference. Ball's article, which is titled, quote, Peace for Israel Hinges on a State for Palestinians, end quote, states the following, quote, Israel's security worries would be largely met by writing stringent, enforceable safeguards into a formal treaty, denying the new Palestinian state any armed force of its own, and limiting the numbers and kinds of weapons available to the police. As a further safeguard, the settlement would require installation of surveillance posts larger and more numerous and effective than those now functioning in the Sinai under Israel's peace agreement with Egypt, end quote. Ball explains that the establishment of what he openly admits would be a, quote, rump state in the West Bank, end quote, is a matter of urgency. Quote, if the United States does not seriously seek to bring the parties together, Ball warns, the warfare in the Holy Land will spread and intensify. Sooner or later, the neighboring Arab states, even Egypt, will be dragged into the maelstrom, end quote. The maelstrom that this imperialist spokesman so strongly fears is the emancipation of the Arab masses of the region from the Israeli colonial settler state, from the feudal sheikhs of the Gulf and the Arabian Peninsula, and from the Egyptian regime, which has reduced the workers and peasants of Egypt to a level of poverty unknown even under King Farouk.
An international conference designed to legitimize the security interests of apartheid Israel in exchange for a Palestinian Bantustan can never be viable, except if a Palestinian leadership were to provide this plan with protective coloration. Such an outcome will merely hand to the PLO the unenviable task of policing the Palestinian people and of converting self-determination into another sad replica of the country-selling regimes which plague the Arab masses from Jordan to Syria and from Egypt to the Gulf. It was but a few years ago that no Palestinian nationalist would dare associate him or herself with so blatant an effort to betray the long years of struggle for Palestinian self-determination and emancipation, let alone translate the Palestinian cause into a plea for a role in preserving the status quo in the region, with its grinding poverty and relentless exploitation and total subordination to U.S. imperialist control. Those who argue that it is practical to propose a two-state solution because this plan is more likely to be accepted are guilty, decency aside, of what C. Wright Mills called crackpot realism. There has never been any component of the Zionist movement, from its nominal right to its self-designated left, which has accepted Palestinian statehood in any form compatible with self-determination. A revealing example of the dangers for the Palestinian revolution of a, quote, mini-state, unquote, proposal comes from the pen of Jerome M. Siegel, a research scholar at the University of Maryland and founder of the Jewish Committee for Israeli-Palestinian Peace. Siegel, who represents the, quote, left-unquote wing of the Zionist movement, writes the following in a February 16, 1988 Los Angeles Times article entitled, "A Palestinian State Serves the Interests of Israelis." Ironically, quote, "all of the alternatives an independent Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, of all the alternatives, an independent Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza is the one solution that best serves Israel's interests and security." Siegel continues, "A Palestinian state would be the fullest possible satisfaction of the demands of Palestinian nationalism. It would win the support of the PLO and is the only likely basis on which the PLO would formally abandon the right to return to the land and villages lost in 1948. As the recognized embodiment of the Palestinian cause, only the PLO can compromise in the name of the Palestinians. A Palestinian state would be a demilitarized mini-state. It will be completely enclosed by Israel on one side and Jordan on the other. No military supplies or forces could reach it without passing through Israel or Jordan. The foreign policy of such a mini-state will be dominated by its links to the Israeli economy and by national security reality. In the event of war, its very existence would be in jeopardy. Israel would not be seriously threatened. For Israel, a Palestinian state is not a charming prospect. It is simply better than the alternatives," unquote. Siegel's call for what amounts to a rump Palestinian state in the West Bank is a mockery of Palestinian self-determination. Indeed, far from being willing to relinquish control of the West Bank and Gaza, the Zionists, as Ben-Gurion, Dayan, and Oded Yinon make clear, are too busy plotting the conquest of Kuwait. The day that African or Palestinian rights are secured with the sanction of apartheid South Africa or by Zionist Israel under U.S. control will be the day we learn that Caligula was a disciple of Jesus, Hitler embraced Marx, and Bull Connor, our eyes rolled to heaven, chanted, "We shall overcome." Meanwhile, the tortured, the dying, the oppressed cannot afford the fantasies of their practical reformist friends. The price of such illusions is paid in blood. The rump Palestinian state of George Ball's vision will be operated for the privileged on the backs of the Palestinian poor. Those Palestinian leaders who embrace this concocted entity, modeled on the inspiring examples of the dependent sheikhdoms of the Gulf and the Bantustans of South Africa, will become the Chiang Kai-sheks, Chombes, and Kings Husseins of suffering Palestine. The rights of the Palestinian people can never be advanced in this way.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We continue with our program, The Way Forward for the Palestinian People. Ralph, what we have discussed and what was originally the elaborated in the PLO Charter is a democratic, secular Palestine. And let's continue with the Strategy for Revolution, the chapter from the Hidden History of Zionism. And this is the section for a democratic, secular Palestine. In 1968, 20 years after the colonial settler state of Israel was established, the Palestinian resistance movement formulated its demand for self-determination in the call for the replacement of the Israeli state with an independent, unitary Palestine. The majority wing of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Fatah, set forth the program for the establishment of a democratic, secular Palestine. This slogan called for the dismantling of the Zionist Israeli state and the establishment of a new state in Palestine in which Jews, Christians, and Arabs would live as equal without discrimination. What was notable about this brave proposal was that, one, it categorically rejected any accommodation with or recognition of the Zionist state, and two, it rejected the proposal for a Palestinian mini-state on the West Bank and Gaza. PLO chairman Yasser Arafat described his proposal as follows in a remarkable biography written by journalist Alan Hart. Quote, "We were saying no to the Zionist state, but we were saying yes to the Jewish people of Palestine. To them we were saying, you are welcome to live in our land, but on one condition. You must be prepared to live among us as equals, not as dominators. I myself have always said that there is only one guarantee for the safety and security of the Jewish people in Palestine, and that is the friendship of the Arabs among whom they live." End quote. A document submitted by Arafat's Fatah organization to the Second World Congress on Palestine in September 1970 spells out the profile of a democratic and secular Palestine even more clearly. The 1970 Fatah document states, quote, "Pre-1948 Palestine, as defined during the British Mandate, is the territory to be liberated. It should be quite obvious at this stage that the new Palestine discussed here is not occupied West Bank or the Gaza Strip or both. These are areas occupied by the Israelis since June 1967. The homeland of the Palestinians usurped and colonized in 1948 is no less dear or important than the part occupied in 1967. Besides, the very existence of the racist oppressor state of Israel, based on the expulsion and forced exile of part of its citizens, even from one tiny village, is unacceptable to the revolution. Any arrangement accommodating the aggressor settler state is unacceptable and temporary. All the Jews, Muslims, and Christians living in Palestine or forcibly exiled from it will have the right to Palestinian citizenship. This means that all Jewish Palestinians, at present Israelis, have the same rights provided, of course, that they reject Zionist racist chauvinism and fully agree to live as Palestinians in the new Palestine. It is the belief of the revolution that the majority of the present Israeli Jews will change their attitudes and will subscribe to the new Palestine, especially after the oligarchic state machinery, economy, and military establishment are destroyed. End quote.
The role of the Soviet bureaucracy. The Soviet bureaucracy reacted sharply to Fatah's attempt to transform the PLO into a revolutionary movement with a program and strategy aimed at mobilizing the masses and winning them for a revolutionary transformation of the settler regime. According to Alan Hart, whose biography of Arafat was, quote, written in cooperation with Yasser Arafat and the top leadership of the PLO, unquote, the Soviet leaders told Arafat that they were fully committed to the existence of the State of Israel and that they had not the slightest intention of supporting or encouraging Palestinian militants or military capacity. Two of Fatah's principal leaders, Khalil al-Hassan and Khalil al-Wazir, Abu Jihad, went to Moscow to explain Fatah's program. They left Moscow to cite Khalid al-Hassan, quote, with the clear impression that the Palestinians would not receive Soviet support for their cause until they were ready to accept Israel's existence inside the borders as they were on the eve of the June 1967 Six-Day War, unquote. And then, quote, because we were ourselves beginning to be educated about the reality of international politics, reflects Hani al-Hassan, Khalid's brother, quote, we realized that we could not expect to advance our cause without the support of at least one of two superpowers. We had knocked on the door of the United States and its Western allies, and we had received no answer, so we wanted to try with the Soviets. We had no choice, unquote. Retreat to the mini-state position.
Ralph, before we go on, I'd like to mention that the Soviet Union, the bureaucracy of the Soviet Union under Stalin, supported the partition plan and imposed upon the Palestinian Communist Party its support for partition. The Palestinian Communist Party described the 1948 Zionist war against the British as a war for national liberation for the Jews. And as a result, thousands of automatic weapons were provided by the Soviet Union, conveyed through Czechoslovakia. And this helped the Zionist paramilitaries establish their superiority as early as June 48.
Maya, let's be very clear about this. Stalin joined with U.S. imperialism to impose a Zionist settler state in Palestine. Stalin joined with Truman in calling for the handing over of 55% of Palestine to the Zionist militia. He armed the Zionist militia, as you mentioned, through Czechoslovakia. Stalin and the Communist parties facilitated the expulsion of the Palestinian population, sanctioned and approved, and in no way resisted the ethnic cleansing, the masses of the Palestinian people, the Nakba, the great catastrophe, from one end of Palestine to the other through a series of massacres, the seizure of 475 towns and villages and the reduction to rubble of 385 towns and villages and the seizure of the land from the remaining 90.
And the expulsion of 750,000 to 800,000 Palestinians out of a total population at the time of 950,000 people. And most of all, what did this arming of the Palestinian militias, particularly Ben-Gurion and the Haganah, mean?
Not the Palestinian.
Zionist militia, excuse me. The Zionist militia, particularly David Ben-Gurion and the Haganah. It allowed Ben-Gurion to build a unified military command, the Haganah, which swallowed, according to Rassan Kanafani, the great Palestinian poet and author, the irregular miniature armies of the Zionist political parties and recast them into a state-controlled mold. And what emerged was a Haganah of 200,000 men by the end of World War II. 200,000 men force against which the Palestinian people were confronted.
Which carried out massacres, systematic ethnic cleansing massacres in town after town, in village after village, a total ethnic slaughter and expulsion of the people of Palestine.
So, Ralph, let us continue now with the hidden history of Zionism, a strategy for revolution, and to go as far as we can, and mainly to articulate what was emerging with this capitulation to the idea of a mini-state.
Well, to frame the discussion of what the issues are in Palestine as they were in South Africa, as they are in any part of the colonially oppressed and exploited sectors of the planet.
Ralph.
Fatah's leaders soon lost all confidence in the possibility of sustaining the political program which they had once proclaimed, that of a democratic and secular Palestine for which they had planned to struggle by mobilizing the Palestinian and Jewish masses. In February 1974, a PLO working paper was formulated which retreated from this program. The paper proposed, quote, to establish a national authority on any lands that can be wrested from Zionist occupation, unquote. Arafat and the majority of his Fatah colleagues were now committed to working for a negotiated, quote, settlement, unquote, which required the Palestinian people to accept the loss, quote, for all time of 70% of their original homeland in exchange for, quote, mini-state, unquote, on the West Bank and Gaza. Arafat only openly acknowledged that the entire Palestinian people were opposed to this policy. Alan Hart writes, quote, Arafat and most of his senior colleagues in the leadership knew they needed time to sell this to the rank and file of the liberation movement. If in 1974 Arafat and his colleagues had openly admitted the true extent of the compromise they were prepared to make, they would have been repudiated and rejected by a great majority of the Palestinians, unquote. Arafat was now embarked upon a course in which he could not tell the truth to his own people about the political line which he and his colleagues had taken. The words are those of Yasser Arafat, quote, our tragedy at the time was that the world refused to understand there were two aspects, two sides to the question of what was possible. First, there was the question of what it was possible for the Palestinians to achieve in practical terms, given the fact that the two superpowers were committed to Israel's existence. But there was also the question of what it was possible for the Palestinian leadership to persuade its people to accept. When a people claims the return of 100% of its usurped land, it is not so easy for leadership to say, no, you can have only 30%, unquote. The disparity between the public posture and the private practice became the touchstone of PLO political practice in this period. With considerable confusion and demoralization among the Palestinian masses arising from it. Arafat is frank about this, quote, you say to me, and you are right, that our public position on the compromise we were prepared to make was ambiguous for many years while we were educating our people about the need for compromise. But I must also tell you that our real position was always known to the governments of the world, notably the government of Israel. How? From 1974, even from the end of 1973, certain of our people were officially authorized to maintain secret contact with Israel and with important people in the West. Their responsibility was to say in secret what at the time we could not say in public, unquote. This clandestine policy was carried out for 5 years, from 1974 to 1979, with neither awareness nor endorsement by the elected members of the Palestine National Council. It required diplomatic maneuvering and lobbying. It also required, to quote Alan Hart, quote, outmaneuvering and outwitting those in the left who were opposed to the mini-state, unquote. Hart explains, quote, if he had put to the test of actual negotiations by Israel between 1974 and 1979, Arafat could not have delivered on the basis of the mini-state formula without completely splitting the PLO, unquote. But inducing the, quote, left, unquote, to acquiesce proved to be like pushing on an open door. And by the time of the 1979 Palestine National Congress, George Habash and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine had endorsed the mini-state plan. Indeed, by 1979, all components of the PLO had adopted the call for a mini-state on the West Bank and Gaza. From 1974 on, all wings of the PLO had demonstrated that they were incapable of formulating an independent revolutionary strategy for the Palestinian people.
As the 1970 Fatah document correctly noted, the future of the struggle of the Palestinian people is tied up with a political strategy which addresses itself to the Israeli Jews and which calls upon them to join with the Palestinians in a struggle for a democratic and secular Palestine. In the time here, we don't have time to fully read from the Hidden History of Zionism, but we would like to discuss what it means, the way forward, and what it means to incorporate and struggle with the Israeli Jews. At the time of the Intifada, in the way forward, Ralph writes, the Palestinian masses are in motion. The extraordinary will to struggle on the part of the entire population has shown that there is no going back. The Intifada needs to focus on specific features of oppression and to challenge them by reclaiming the land, planting forbidden crops, sinking wells, withholding labor in the course of demanding unconditional Israeli withdrawal. A revolutionary Palestinian leadership will need to devise a program for Inside the Green Line, which addresses the Jews within Israel as well as the Muslims and Christians. In short, what is necessary is a blueprint for a post-Zionist society, which inspires people and associates the inequities of their lives with the Zionist state. As the Zionist state is at once a species of capitalist class rule and an extension of U.S. imperial power in the region, the struggle against Zionism becomes programmatically a struggle for a socialist Palestine, and as the dawn follows the long night, a struggle for a socialist Arab East from the Mediterranean to the Gulf. A PLO faithful to its promise of a democratic secular Palestine would include in its leadership those anti-Zionist Jews who have fought the colonial settler state. In this way, the Jewish masses themselves would be able to see who really speaks for them and who offers them a way out of perpetual war, insecurity, and deprivation. A clear call for a democratic and secular Palestine is essential to uniting mass social forces capable of dismantling the Zionist state and replacing it with a humane society dedicated to the ending of class and national oppression. The Palestinian revolutionary movement can only advance by hammering out a new strategy based on combining the Palestinian national struggle with the struggle of the workers and peasants of the whole Middle East for liberation from both capitalist and imperialist domination, for a socialist Middle East. There is no shortcut to liberation, as the century-old ordeal of the Palestinian people has shown. The road to victory will only be shortened when a leadership arises which knows its direction and proposes the path in a language which enlists the people, mobilizes them in their own behalf, and exposes fearlessly the false leaders dangerously in the way.
The Palestinian answer to the Zionist and imperialist schemes can be found in the stone-throwing children of Jabalia, the beach camp, Balata, and Deheshi. For this, as Jabotinsky was obliged by them to acknowledge, is a people. A living people. Not a rabble, but a conscious people fighting with stones and slingshots against the fourth largest military power in the world. We owe them, at the very least, fidelity to their revolutionary struggle, which can never be complete until it extends from the Mediterranean to the Persian Gulf, from the Brook of Egypt to the Euphrates, and, as their Zionist oppressors forever proclaim, and beyond.
Ralph, in the moments that remain, I think we need to be more specific about a strategy for a democratic secular Palestine, because today we have people, fortunately, calling for what is known as a one-state solution. But the references are made to reconciliation, such as in South Africa, or a framework, such as in Belgium, a false premise of what a national or binational state might mean. And you're very clear on the limitations of these formulations and the difference between that and a revolutionary struggle for a democratic secular Palestine, which is encompassing the struggle for socialism.
Point one. The entire Zionist project was at the behest of imperialism since the 1890s. from the Russian Tsar to the German Kaiser to French colonial imperialism to the British Raj to American imperialism itself. The Zionist leadership presented itself as the instrument of imperial control of the region. They presented themselves as the vehicle for expelling and removing the indigenous population and setting themselves up as a local force to undermine the Arab national revolution against colonial and imperial control. When we reference South Africa has a specific application in the following sense. For nearly 500 years, there was a settler population that had colonized and subjugated the people of Africa in what is South Africa today. Yet no one suggested that the Boers or the English had, by virtue of their colonial subjugation of that population, thereby acquired the right to an exclusive settler state on the land of the dispossessed. Everybody understood that the dismantling of an apartheid state was the elementary basic predicate for self-determination, that a colonial settler population does not enjoy the equivalent right to so-called self-determination on the land of the people who they have dispossessed. And consequently, with reference to Palestine, the Zionist state from 9/11 to the elimination of national resistance in all parts of the Arab East to the present permanent war of dismantling Arab national regimes that in any way can respond to the aspirations of their population, that is the underlying meaning of a Zionist presence in Palestine. And consequently, there will not be, a liberation movement that does not link the Palestinian struggle to the aspirations of the masses when the 200-person feudal family of Asaba in Kuwait had 20 years ago $2.8 trillion in European and Japanese banks. Talk about flight capital. We see the nature and role of these regimes. South Africa, however, is now being invoked by those who have finally come to the realization that the so-called mini-state in the West Bank and Gaza is the state of subjugation, the state of total degradation, the state of permanent devastation, and that the role that the PLO and the Palestinian Authority have now assumed makes Chiang Kai-shek look democratic by comparison. They are the cat's paws of the Central Intelligence Agency and the policing and subjugation of the Palestinian masses themselves. But let us understand, too, brothers and sisters, that the example of South Africa presents us with another lesson. You can integrate the beaches of Durban, but as long as Harry Oppenheimer owns the mines, the masses will live in subjugated oppression and exploitation in South Africa. There is not a single structure in South Africa, from the ocean to the desert, from its mountains to its crowded townships, which had not been built with the back-breaking labor of its people. Racism was the ideological glue needed to hold together this barbarous system, and it has not changed by allowing a few black faces in nominal high places. On the contrary, the poverty of the masses has been criminalized as never before. In the midst of vast wealth, they are unemployed. The debt of Fervoet to the International Monetary Fund continues to be paid. Over 55% are counted amongst the unemployed, and these figures exclude those who do not enter the labor market. Racism is embedded in the system of control. The white highlands and the land that was seized by the settlers entirely remains in the hands of the European settler population in South Africa. The gross domestic product grows 1% annually. The population grows nearly 4% in the same period. Over 45% of the people are illiterate. Unemployment increases by 7% a year. In short, brothers and sisters, a national bourgeois regime that administers the system of exploitation of imperialism cannot liberate the people, and never has. As in South Africa, so in Palestine and in the suffering Arab East, the struggle against the Zionist colonial subjugation of the Palestinian masses is inextricably linked the struggle for emancipation from economic subjugation and neocolonial exploitation and control. There will be no realization of a liberation of a people until, as Rassan Kanafani said, it is understood that the struggle for Palestine passes through Beirut and Cairo and Mecca and Riyadh and Damascus and Baghdad, that the liberation in Palestine is inextricably bound up, as the masses are beginning to mobilize in Egypt and Jordan around the subjugation of the people of Palestine. So they are enlisting their voices and their struggle in their own behalf as well. There is no shortcut. You cannot make revolution like Nescafe. We need program. We need clarity. We need organization. We need leadership. We need a clear understanding of the nature of imperialism. We need a decisive clarity about the meaning of the Zionist genocidal destruction of the Palestinian population. A system of subjugation and control is inherent in capitalist and imperialist control of the riches of the region, of the organized existence of the masses as a force in their own history and emancipation. That is the heart and soul of the meaning of a democratic and secular Palestine, not a confessional state like that of Lebanon, not a state in which the surrogates of the imperial controllers of the resources and land of the people administer that for their masters afar, but a struggle for control over life, over land, over resources, for the democratic determination of how existence is organized, of how resources are applied, for a socialist transformation of Palestine and the Arab East in its entirety.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Shunman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Way Forward for the Palestinian People, will be on our archive, www.takingaimradio.com. This has been the sixth in our series that began December 4th. Please see our entire series on our website. I'd also like to mention a very important event. It's taking place at St. Mary's Church on
The 28th of January at 7 p.m., brothers and sisters, mobilize for Lynn Stewart at St. Mary's Church at 521 West 128th Street.
26th Street.
26th Street, January 28th.
In New York. And also, please attend the court session January 29th at 2 p.m., Southern District of New York, 500 Pearl Street, enter on Worth Street in New York. It's the ceremonial courtroom on the ninth floor north to hear the appellate discussion for Lynn Stewart. Please rally for Lynn Stewart. This is the oral argument on appeal. Please attend the meeting, St. Mary's Church, 521 West 126th Street, January 28th, 7 p.m. This is Taking Aim, and we'll be with you next week. Tatan ta chinda taro, tatan ta. Kilo nokmi wa.